Hello and welcome to another edition of Yellow Star China News. Today is Thursday, January 10th, 2019. The first article for today comes from the New York Times, entitled Talks to End U.S.-China Trade War Now Shift to Make or Break Rounds. Beijing. 3 days of trade negotiations between mid-level American and Chinese officials ended in Beijing on Wednesday afternoon with progress in identifying and narrowing the two sides' differences, but little sense of when they might reach a deal. The trade talks could help clear the way for higher-level talks this month when President Trump attends the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Vice Premier Liu He, China's economic czar, is expected to go to Washington sometime after that. In a statement after the talks ended, the United States Trade Representative's office said the two sides had discussed China's pledge to buy a substantial amount of American agricultural, energy, and manufacturing products. Negotiators also focused on White House concerns about China's approach to intellectual property protection and its practice of so-called forced technology transfer, the statement said. The Trump administration wants to ensure that China keeps its commitments in any deal that is expected. To that end, the statement said, officials discussed the need for any agreement to provide for complete implementation subject to ongoing verification and effective enforcement. China's Commerce Ministry said in a statement on Thursday morning on its official mini-blogging account that the two sides had conducted extensive, in-depth, and meticulous exchanges on trade issues and structural issues of common concern, which enhanced mutual understanding and laid the foundation for resolving mutual concerns. Both parties agreed to continue to maintain close contact, the statement continued, without specifying when or where the next meeting might be held. The United States delegation plans to report back to the White House to determine what happens next. The administration has set a March 2nd deadline for raising tariffs on roughly two-fifths of annual American imports from China if no deal is reached. I'm optimistic that they're making progress. The tone of the talks is important and this tone has been good, said Dean Pinkert, a former commissioner of the United States International Trade Commission who is now a trade law partner at Hughes, Hubbard & Reed, a big international law firm. It is still important to the U.S. government to get credible commitments. An issue is the extent to which China is willing to offer binding commitments to change trade practices that have long irked President Trump and his administration. The scheduled two-day talks extended into a third day as American officials pressed China for more details on how it will live up to its commitments, said people with knowledge of the negotiations, who insisted on anonymity to avoid disrupting the talks. China has made a series of offers to the Trump administration in recent weeks to end the trade war, but many of the administration's trade hawks regard them as nebulous, especially when it comes to Chinese trade practices that administration officials consider unfair. They allege that officials in China pressure foreign companies to transfer key technologies to Chinese rivals as a condition for entering the country's market. They also protest lavish government subsidies granted through the Made in China 2025 program to build local companies into global powerhouses in industries like commercial aircraft, semiconductors, and electric cars. China denies that its trade practices have been unfair. Nevertheless, officials have agreed to make it easier for multinational corporations to participate in manufacturing development programs in China. They've also promised to improve intellectual property protection and to ban the forced transfer of technology. Both sides see reasons to reach a deal soon. Mr. Trump wants to stabilize volatile financial markets, people familiar with the administration's deliberations said. President Xi Jinping of China is trying to confront weak business and consumer confidence, which have already triggered a sharp economic slowdown in his country. Adding to the difficulty of reaching a deal has been the fractious nature of the Trump administration, with the three main government departments involved in the negotiations each pursuing a somewhat different agenda. Those different agendas to some extent reflect each agency's institutional biases and responsibilities, but make it harder to predict what a final deal will look like. Robert E. Lighthizer, the United States trade representative and a hawk on trade issues, has led the push to improve tariffs on imports from China and has pursued an ambitious agenda that would require China to carry out verifiable and enforceable charges to the basic structure of its economy. Mr. Trump said last month that Mr. Lighthizer would be the lead trade negotiator with China. The Commerce Department, which oversees American export promotion activities overseas, and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross have been pushing since the early days of the administration for a deal that would require China to buy more food, natural gas, and other products from the United States. Beijing officials have been happy to go along as their country is short on arable land and gas, and long-term purchase agreements fit easily into the Chinese government's economic planning model. The Treasury Department, under Secretary Steven Mnuchin, has been pushing for a quick deal that would stop further increases in American tariffs. But Treasury would preserve indefinitely the 25% tariffs that Mr. Trump imposed in July and August on $50 billion a year in Chinese-made goods, or roughly a tenth of American imports, and the 10% tariffs that he imposed in September on an additional $200 billion in Chinese goods. That first set of tariffs covers several categories in which China does not export much now, but plans to do so in the next several years. The most important products covered by the 25% tariffs are gasoline-powered and electric cars. At least six Chinese automakers have announced plans to start exporting cars to the United States into 2020, said Michael Dunn, the chief executive of ZOZOGO, an automotive consulting firm specializing in China. Import duties will slow, but not stop, Chinese automakers' plans to enter the U.S., he said. With a slowing home market, pressure to export has never been greater. Democrats and Republicans alike have been wary of allowing an influx of Chinese cars in an election year, particularly when manufacturing states like Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin have been among the main electoral battlegrounds in recent decades. In the latest sign that the Chinese economy could use a lift from a trade agreement, officials announced Wednesday evening that car sales plummeted 19% last month from a year earlier, the steepest such decline in modern record-keeping in China. Mr. Trump and Mr. Xi agreed in Buenos Aires on December 1st to a temporary truce that would keep last summer's American tariffs in place and suspend much of China's retaliation for those tariffs, but had few other details. So the quickest possible deal in the coming weeks could be to make that arrangement, more permanent. Complicating the trade talks has been Mr. Xi's decision to invite North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, to visit Beijing this week. Mr. Trump has been pushing North Korea to abandon the development of missiles with nuclear warheads that can reach the United States, but he needs China's cooperation to do so because China is North Korea's main ally and largest trading partner. Yonhap, the South Korean news agency, reported that Mr. Kim left Beijing early Wednesday afternoon about the same time that the trade talks ended. Liu Kang, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman, decided to decline to provide details. The second article for today comes from The Guardian, entitled China's Ambassador Accuses Canada of White Supremacy in Huawei CFO Arrest. China's ambassador to Canada has accused the country of white supremacy in calling for the release of two Canadians detained in China last month. The arrests were in apparent retaliation for the arrest of a top Chinese tech executive in Canada. But Ambassador Liu Xiaoye said in an op-ed in the Ottawa-based Hill Times on Wednesday that Western countries are employing a double standard in demanding the immediate release of the Canadians. The reason why some people are used to arrogantly adopting double standards is due to the Western egotism and white supremacy, Liu wrote. What they have been doing is not showing respect for the rule of law, but mocking and trampling the rule of law. China detained Canadian ex-diplomat Michael Kovrig and entrepreneur Michael Spavor on the 10th of December 2018 on vague allegations of engaging in activities that endanger the national security of China. The arrests came 10 days after Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou was arrested in Canada at the request of the US, which wants her extradited to face charges that she misled banks about the country's business dealings in Iran. A Canadian judge granted Meng bail while she awaits extradition proceedings. Liu wrote that elites in Canada are completely dismissing China's law by demanding the immediate release of the Canadians. It seems that, to some people, only Canadian citizens shall be treated in a humanitarian manner and their freedom deemed valuable, while Chinese people do not deserve that, Liu said. Liu also wrote that Meng was arrested without violating any Canadian law, suggesting that Canada should never detain someone for extradition. Roland Paris, a former foreign policy advisor to Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, called Liu's claims hogwash. I don't know what the ambassador was trying to accomplish, but his article won't help China's cause, Paris said. Paris noted, Canada is following extradition law while the Canadians were seized in China under suspicious circumstances, and China has held them without charge. Julian Koo, the Senior Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at Hofstra Law, noted China has still not revealed any specific information about what Kovrig and Spavor are charged with, and have not given them a judicial hearing, and thus Canada is not wrong with calling the arrests arbitrary. I am struck by how brazen they are being by making this appeal, Koo said. He says, you are being racist by not respecting our law. That's an easy card to play. Liu also seemed to admit detaining the Canadians was in retaliation for the Hmong arrest. I have recently heard a word repeatedly pronounced by some Canadians, bullying. They said that by arresting two Canadian citizens as retaliation for Canada's detention of Hmong, China was bullying Canada. To those people, China's self-defense is an offense to Canada, Liu wrote. Alex Lawrence, a spokesman for Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland, did not address Liu's claims. Huawei, whose billionaire founder Ren Zhengfei has long had ties with both the People's Liberation Army and the Communist Party, has faced national security concerns in multiple countries. Huawei has been banned from involvement in the installation of 5G mobile networks in India, New Zealand, and Australia, blocked from making acquisitions in the US, and banned from selling phones on military bases by the Pentagon. But in his column, Liu dismissed such concerns and instead pointed to monitoring and spying programs carried out by the U.S. National Security Agency and the Five Eyes Alliance countries, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the UK, and the U.S. Something is considered as safeguarding national security when it is done by Western countries, but it is termed conducting espionage when done by China. What's the logic? He wrote. The third article for today comes from The Telegraph, entitled The Real Thing, How Coca-Cola Shaped China's Obesity Policy. Drinks giant Coca-Cola has shaped the Chinese government's obesity policy over the last 30 years, pushing the idea that a lack of exercise is the main cause of overweight and obesity rather than poor nutrition, according to research. An investigation published in the BMJ Medical Journal has found that through a complex web of connections with the Chinese government, Coke has been able to ensure that its own message, which promotes the importance of physical activity over healthy eating, has been at the heart of the country's approach to tackling obesity. Coca-Cola has long positioned its product as one which can be enjoyed as part of a healthy lifestyle, where that message has been diluted by growing concerns over sugar and the imposition of taxes on soft drinks around the world. In advance of the introduction of the sugar tax in the UK last April, Coca-Cola reduced the size of its bottles and introduced new products. Susan Greenhall, professor of Chinese society at Harvard University, has investigated the International Life Sciences Institute, ILSI, set up by a Coke executive 40 years ago in the United States and whose Chinese branch, ILSI China, is housed within a unit of the country's health ministry. The institute is funded by some of the world's biggest food and drink companies, including Coke, Nestle, McDonald's, and PepsiCo. It seems itself as a bridge between the government, academia, and industry, providing the latest evidence for policy decisions on nutrition, food safety, and chronic disease prevention and control. But Professor Greenhall says that, via ILSI China, the company has cleverly maneuvered itself into a position of behind-the-scenes power that ensures the government policy to fight the growing obesity epidemic does not undermine its interests. Obesity and overweight are a growing problem in China. Around 40% of the population were overweight or obese in 2014, up from just over 20% in 1991. Obesity alone has increased from nearly 3% in men to just over 11%, and in women from more than 4% to 11% over the same period. Between 1999 and 2003, ILSI China assembled a group of obesity experts who published guidelines on the prevention of obesity on behalf of the Ministry of Health. Over the coming years, a focus on physical activity began to take precedence in China's obesity policy, and much of the government activity in this area focused on the importance of exercise rather than diet, Professor Gui Hall says. She says that ILSI China was behind a number of high-profile public health initiatives such as Happy 10 Minutes, a nationwide campaign in China's schools which promoted the idea of 10-minute breaks in the school day for exercise. ILSI China organized 6 international scientific conferences on obesity featuring Coca-Cola-funded U.S.-based researchers. The company has also funded fellowships for Chinese scientists. The effects of the Coca-Cola's influence is hard to measure, admits Professor Greenhall, but China has so far failed to implement any of the World Health Organization's recommendations on dietary policy, such as a tax on sugar or restricting sugary drink advertisements to children. Barry Popkin, professor of nutrition at the University of North Carolina, said China had no plans to regulate the food and drinks industry in the way that other countries are doing. He said, "I believe ILSI's influence in promoting the physical ability agenda was extremely detrimental and put China decades behind in efforts to create a healthier diet for its citizens." The fourth article for today comes from The Guardian, entitled "Toe the Line, China Bans Foot Fetish Videos and Political Spoofs as Censorship Tightens." China released new guidelines on censoring short videos on Wednesday, prohibiting everything from foot fetishes to spoofing the national anthem, as Beijing continues to clamp down on harmful information. The China Netcasting Services Association, one of the country's largest government-backed internet associations, published a detailed list of 100 types of content that short video platforms must scrub. Political subjects topped the list, including Taiwan independence, criticism of Communist Party's leaders, and parodying China's national anthem. The new rules also cover a wide range of other topics, including money worship, unhealthy views of marriage and love, and unverified footage of protests and gatherings. They also apply to non-video content on the apps, including subtitles, comments, and video titles. Over the past year, Beijing has ramped up its crackdown on illegal online content as the government tightens its policing of China's already heavily censored web, which blocks many foreign websites like Google and Facebook. In 2018, Chinese authorities shuttered 26,000 illegal websites and deleted about 6 million online posts containing vulgar content, official news agency Xinhua said on Monday. China's cyberspace authority last year also scrubbed over 9,000 accounts on Chinese social media platforms like messaging app WeChat and the Twitter-like Weibo, accusing them of spreading politically harmful information and rumors. On top of releasing guidelines on barred content, the government-backed Internet Association, which includes state media and tech corporates like Alibaba and Tencent, also published guidelines on short video management on Wednesday. The list encourages short video operators to introduce accounts run by the Chinese government and military to improve the supply of positive and high-quality videos. It also says that short video companies should assemble content auditing teams that are very politically attuned, and that video censors should be trained by provincial and national radio and television authorities. The final article for today comes from CNN, entitled "Rare 19th Century Images Show China at the Dawn of Photography." Before the arrival of photography, the Western imagination of China was based on paintings, written travelogues, and dispatches from a seemingly far-off land. From the 1850s, however, a band of pioneering Western photographers sought to capture the country's landscapes, cities, and people, captivating audiences back home and sparking a homegrown photography movement in the process. Among them were the Italian Felice Bieto, who arrived in China in the 1850s to document Anglo-French exploits in the Second Opium War, and Scottish photographer John Thompson, whose journey up the Min River offered people in the West a rare look into the country's remote interior. These are just some of the figures whose work features in a 15,000-strong photo collection amassed by New York antiquarian and collector Stefan Lowenthal. His 19th-century images span street scenes, tradespeople, rural life, and architecture, showing an unprecedented detail, everything from blind beggars to camel caravans on the Silk Road. A rare book dealer by trade, Lowenthal has spent the last three decades acquiring the pictures from auctions and collectors, both in and around China. They form what he claims to be the world's largest private collection of early Chinese photography, and given the number of artworks and artifacts lost in the country's turbulent 20th century, during Mao's Cultural Revolution in particular, the claim is entirely reasonable. Now, he has put 120 of the prints on display in Beijing for the first time. The exhibition's scope runs from the 1850s, the very genesis of paper photographs in China, until the 1880s. It features examples of the earliest form of photography, such as albumen print, which uses egg whites to bind chemicals to paper, and the wet plate process, in which negatives were processed on glass plates in a portable dock room. These technological developments heralded the birth of commercial photography in China, as they allowed images to be quickly replicated and spread for the very first time. "People wanted to bring back great images that they could sell in other places," said Lowenthal. "People who traveled there, everyone from diplomats and businessmen to missionaries, all wanted to bring home a record of this beautiful culture of China that was so unique. Some of them had a market back home, but immediately they found a Chinese love for photography, and they developed a strong market inside the country. Chinese photographers then picked up on that and served both markets. Despite the prominent role of foreigners in early Chinese photography, the exhibition and Lorenthal's collection at large also aims to honor the achievement of the country's own practitioners. Some purchased cameras from departing Westerners looking to sell their cumbersome equipment, while others took advantage of Chinese innovation in the field, such as mathematician Zhou Boqi, who used foreign-made products to design his own glass plate camera. Having first arrived in port cities, photography spread throughout China in the latter half of the 19th century. This led to the creation of commercial studios specializing in portraits of individuals and families, with many of the pictures later hand-colored by trained painters. Pioneering figures like Lai Afong produced portraits, landscapes, and cityscapes that were, in Lowenthal's eyes, equal in quality to those of their Western contemporaries. There is an equality in Chinese photography and of Chinese photographers that is not sufficiently known in China, the collector said. Some of the very earliest Chinese photographers were brilliant. Instead of copying their foreign forebears, China's photographers were often inspired by their own artistic traditions. Portraits, for instance, were treated more like paintings in their composition and use of light. Lowenthal said, sitters were often pictured facing the camera, straight on and wearing little or no expression, with early portraits appearing to simulate painted Chinese ancestor portraits. Images of architecture, meanwhile, embraced the surrounding nature rather than focusing on the buildings in isolation, another divergence from the Western tradition. Very often, when we have an unidentified photographer, we have a pretty good idea whether they're Chinese or Western, Lowenthal added. Beyond their artistic value, Lowenthal's images also appear to be of academic interest. His current exhibition is taking place at Beijing's Tsinghua University, one of China's leading colleges. The arrival of foreign technology, including cameras, during the 19th century was just one of the radical changes that would bring the imperial era to an end. China became a republic in 1912, following a four-month revolution. As such, photos from the time capture a world that would quickly disappear from sight. Take, for instance, the work of Englishman Thomas Child, an engineer who documented the intricacies of China's traditional architecture. His pictures of Beijing Summer Palace, which was subsequently burned down by for English and French invaders, offer an invaluable record of its lost architecture. Photography is the greatest preserver of history, Lowenthal said. For many years, the written word was the way that history was transmitted. But the earliest photography preserves culture in China and elsewhere, as it had been for many hundreds of years, because it was simultaneous with the technological revolutions that were to change everything. And while Lowenthal has made a business of collecting, he maintains that the images have been brought together for posterity's sake. He sees himself as the custodian of a historical archive, one that should eventually return to its birthplace. And he is currently digitizing the collection with a view to creating an online repository for historians and researchers. We really want this to be an asset to the Chinese people, and we're open to academics or intellectuals who want to study the photos, he said. My hope is that the collection will end up in China. It's not for sale, but from a cultural, intellectually honest perspective, it's something that doesn't belong with me. Well, good for him. Hopefully some of you guys would get to see this art exhibit. So, thanks for listening, and see you next time. Be sure to like my Facebook page, Yellow Star China News. Goodbye.